other headlines, Palestinian resistance forces bring down an Israeli drone in the besieged Gaza Strip a day after another Israeli drone was downed in Lebanon. The UN expresses concern about the situation of Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar following a Monday coup there. And the UK-based oil and gas giant BP announces a huge full-year loss, the first in a decade, as the coronavirus pandemic hits global energy demand. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Palestinian resistance forces have downed an Israeli drone in the besieged Gaza Strip. The aircraft was brought down in an area east of the city of Khan Yunis. Our correspondent Ashraf Shannon has more.
Palestinian resistance factions east of the southern Gaza Strip of Khan Yunis have managed to down an Israeli reconnaissance drone this morning. This is the second time this happens this week. On Sunday, an Israeli drone was intercepted from the skies of northern Gaza near the Beit Hanun crossing. Meanwhile, Israeli military has said that Hamas resistance fighters have been using technology to bring down Israeli drones. What's interesting here that three drones have been downed over in less than a week, two in the Gaza Strip, one in the southern Lebanon by Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah. And last year, at least a dozen Israeli drones were brought in, down in the Gaza Strip. This shows you that the Israeli regime keeps talking about the superiority of its military, but Palestinian resistance groups in Gaza with limited capability are able to bring down such drones.
Palestinian media have reported that Israeli forces have shot dead Palestinians, injured two others in the city of Tamara. Israel authorities say police opened fire after two Palestinians began shooting. Now we are joined by our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, to tell us more.
According to our information, the city of Tamra, first of all, it's occupied by Israel in 1948. It's one of the Palestinian Arab cities, of course, inside the territory, is occupied in 1948. What happened, according to the Israeli police, that during a police patrol at night, they saw a number of people opening fire towards one of the houses. Then the Israeli police used their gun, shot dead two, and wounded two others. We have to make it clear that this continues to happen in the Arab cities in the lands occupied in 1948. Of course, experts say if the Israeli police were 100% confirmed that the shooters or even the suspects are Jewish people, Israelis, of course the Israeli police will never open fire to kill them. But because the city of Tamra is Arab-Palestinian city, and the police know very well that those suspects are Palestinians, so it's easy for them to use their fire to shoot and kill people. Mourning and a general strike has been declared in the city of Tamra. Palestinians went in protest and demonstrations, and at the same time, the Israeli police used the stun grenades in order to disperse the people, again, only because they are Arab Palestinians living in Arab cities. If they were Jewish people, of course, the issue would be completely different.
Thank you very much, our correspondent Mona Kandel from Ramallah. Myanmar's capital is under heavy security a day after the military seized power in a coup. Thousands of soldiers have been deployed across the city. Checkpoints have been set up, too. Myanmar's army staged its coup on Monday and declared a one-year state of emergency. It detained the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, and other members of the ruling party. On Tuesday, the ousted National League for Democracy Party demanded the immediate release of its members. It called for the acknowledgement of the results of last year's election that the party won by a landslide. Myanmar's army claimed vote fraud and staged a coup in response. The United Nations has expressed concern about the situation of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims currently in Myanmar following a Monday coup.
There are about 600,000 Rohingyas that remain in Rakhine State, including 120,000 people who are, you know, effectively confined to camps. They cannot move freely and have extremely limited access to basic health and educational services. So our fear is that the events may make the situation worse.
The UN officials said the recent coup also have a negative impact on the repatriation of Rohingya refugees from Bangladesh to Myanmar. Rohingya Muslims are a minority group that mainly live in Myanmar's Rakhine State. In August 2017, Myanmar's military launched a brutal crackdown against them. Some 700,000 members of the Rohingya community fled and took refuge in neighboring Bangladesh. The UN has called the crackdown a genocide. Oil giant British Petroleum has reported a massive $20.3 billion full-year loss in 2020. The British energy major said the loss contrasted with a net profit of $4 billion in 2019. BP blamed the loss on the coronavirus pandemic that ravaged global energy demand. The company said the loss was mainly caused by tumbling oil and gas prices, as well as significant impairments and exploration write-offs. Last year, BP downsized its global workforce by 15%, cutting almost 10,000 jobs. Professor of Economics Steve Keen believes other oil companies would also suffer losses because of the impacts of the pandemic on the oil industry.
Because one of the areas that's been most hit by the virus is transportation. So, of course, any company supplying oil is going to suffer badly. And I think we should really regard this not as just a one-off, but potentially a warning of what's likely to come in the future. Because, as we know, we're going to be forced by global warming to slow down our use of fossil fuels, and it may well be that oil will be one of the first major stranded assets, of course, along with coal. Well, to some extent, they're being horsed on their own petard. They should have been making a much faster move towards renewable energy themselves. They've done plenty of public relations on that, but very little substance. And now coronavirus has come along, caught them by surprise. All their assets are caught up in fossil fuels, and they're paying a very large price for it. So to some extent, it's a comeuppance for the companies which have played a major role in general, not picking one company out here, but the fossil fuel companies in general have been downplaying the dangers of climate change. Well, they may be the first major victim, so it's time they change their tune.
Afghan officials say a series of rush hour car bombs have rocked the capital, Kabul. Police say three explosions happened, killing two people. They say four others, including two security personnel, were also wounded. Police say one of the blasts targeted an Interior Ministry vehicle. To the north of Kabul, a police car was also targeted in Parwan province. No casualties were caused there. No group has yet claimed responsibility for these attacks. Violence has surged in Afghanistan in recent months. Officials, security personnel, and journalists have been among the main targets of these attacks. A correspondent, Amin Alemi in Kabul, says today's blasts in the city have caused widespread condemnation in Afghanistan.
Today's blasts in Kabul faced vast condemnations inside Afghanistan. Top government officials, including Abdullah Abdullah, the head of Afghanistan's High Reconciliation Council, strongly condemned these attacks and named them brutal attacks on freedom and against the religious scholars and against the values of the people of Afghanistan. In the meantime, many other bodies, especially the Taliban, has also reacted to these recent incidents, mainly the recent three back-to-back explosions in Kabul. According to the spokesperson of Taliban, the group condemns targeting journalists, media workers, and rights bodies, as well as religious scholars. This comes as the Afghan government and many local and international rights bodies, as well as political bodies, have repeatedly blamed the Taliban militant group for launching such attacks against different actors in Afghanistan, including journalists and, as I mentioned, media workers and even politicians and political activists, to spread fear and hopelessness among them in order to put further pressure on the society on the one hand and on the Afghan government, mainly on President Ghani's administration on the other hand.
Iran has once again warned that time is not unlimited for the United States to come back to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif issued the warning in response to recent comments by top officials of U.S. President Joe Biden's administration. Here are the details.
Iran's foreign minister has rejected the U.S. president's call on Tehran to return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear accord before Washington ends what Mohammad Javad Zarif called its full economic war on Iran. In an exclusive interview with CNN, Zarif said, even after Iran rolled back its commitments, it remained in full compliance with the accord.
If you read paragraph 36, we acted in strict accordance with the nuclear agreement. Now the United States needs to come back into compliance, and Iran will be ready immediately to respond.
He said the burden is now on the U.S. to prove its credibility.
The side that has not been able to show that it fulfills its promises has been the United States. And as I said, the United States needs to prove its bona fides. We have already proven our bona fides.
Zarif also said Iran is ready to reverse the steps it has taken under the nuclear deal to reduce its cooperation once the U.S. returns to its obligations. Zarif said that it is possible if the coordinator of the deal's joint commission, namely the EU foreign policy chief, synchronizes the steps each side should take.
He can put his hat as the coordinator of the joint position and sort of choreograph the actions that are needed to be taken by the United States and the actions that are needed to be taken by Iran.
Last week, the new U.S. Secretary of State said Iran must return to the limits set by the nuclear deal before Washington makes any move on the accord. Iran started scaling back its commitments in May 2019, exactly a year after then-US President Donald Trump withdrew his country from the agreement. Iran did so in response to the pullout and Trump's reimposition of sanctions on Tehran. Iran also cited the failure of the European signatories to compensate for the U.S. pullout and protect Tehran's economic benefits from the nuclear agreement. Iran says those benefits should be served if the U.S. or others want its full cooperation.
Turkish police have detained nearly 160 people in Istanbul during protests at one of the country's top universities. Police in full gear took away students in front of Bulgasche University after they refused to scatter. Clashes erupted when protesters began to chant slogans such as "Police get out." Students and professors are angry at the appointment of a new chancellor by President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. They say the appointment of Melih Bulu is undemocratic. The Istanbul governor's office says it has launched an investigation into the protest. World Health Organization experts investigating COVID-19 origins have visited an animal health facility in China's central city of Wuhan. The team has already visited key hospitals, the Regional Disease Control Center, and a Wuhan seafood market. The first cluster of COVID infections is believed to have originated from that market in late 2019. The WHO is trying to piece together how the novel coronavirus might have jumped from animals to humans. It began its investigation last week. The organization says the probe may not find all the answers to the origins of the pandemic. The UN agency has blasted critics of its investigation. It said those claiming to know better how the pandemic broke out should come forward. The European Commission moves to reassure citizens over the EU's COVID-19 vaccination strategy following a litany of errors. Health experts fear the way authorities and the bloc have so far handled the vaccine rollout might discourage a lot of people from taking the jab. From Brussels, Jerome Hughes reports.
On the streets of the EU's de facto capital, Brussels, it is certainly not difficult to find people willing to talk about their frustrations surrounding the 27-nation bloc's coronavirus vaccination rollout strategy.
We get a lot of information, but it's so different every day that it's hard to get a good view of the situation.
A lot of businesses getting shut down and stuff. So I think the faster we get the vaccine, the faster we'll open things back up.
A tiny percentage of the EU's 446 million population has so far been vaccinated. The European Commission is accused of being too slow to sign contracts with pharmaceutical firms. The European Medicines Agency is criticised for not approving vaccines quickly enough. EU member states have failed to prepare to administer the jabs. The European Commission has just introduced controls to monitor where vaccines produced in the EU are being exported to.
This is in order to really protect the advance purchase agreements that we have already signed and which safeguard that we have the availability of the vaccines that are contained in this advance purchase agreement.
Following pressure from the Commission for allegedly breaching contracts, AstraZeneca says it will now deliver 40 million vaccine doses to the EU before the end of next month. But that's still half the number originally envisaged. The way all parties have been acting has damaged public confidence, health professionals warn.
The concern is this could result in a large cohort refusing to take the vaccine. That would obviously have wide-ranging consequences for the EU's fight against COVID-19.
During a European Parliament debate, there were heated exchanges over the vaccine supply issues.
We expect all pharmaceutical companies to honour this contractual agreement with the European Union without further delay. Anything else is unacceptable.
For now at least, the European Commission's goal to ensure 70% of the EU's population is vaccinated before the end of August appears to be on shaky ground. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The United Nations says a Central African Republic is facing a dire humanitarian situation following weeks of violence. The UN says high insecurity on the main supply route from Cameroon has blocked humanitarian deliveries. That comes as the UN projects 2.3 million people in the CAR were already in need of food. The world body says there is also malnutrition among 200,000 newly displaced people. Violence broke out in the Central African Republic nearly 2 months ago. It is blamed on the former president of the country and his allies. The unrest erupted after a constitutional court rejected his candidacy to run for president in December. And with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyeh in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
My dear ones, you should play a leading role in the second phase of the revolution as well. And you will do so, God willing. The people of Tabriz are proud of this day of Allah, the 29th of Bahman. Notice that this is an important point. This is very important. There are some people who are weak, desperate, and inactive. They might have made a revolutionary move one day, but they are now ashamed of their past, under the pressure of the enemy's plot, and more importantly, due to the worldly temptations. However, the people of Tabriz are proud of their revolutionary past, like the majority of the Iranian nation. They are proud of it and they hold their heads up. They say that it was they who established the tradition of Arba'ins, which is a revolutionary movement. They are right and they are proud of it. The very essence of your gathering here, this great and enthusiastic gathering, marked by the large presence of you youth, is one of the pivots and signs of this grand and significant pride and honor.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. My Lord,
my Lord,
protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
Well, I would like to raise certain points about the 29th of Bahman, which is the main issue that I want to raise. However, before that, I wish to raise 2 points in this opportunity that I have. The first point is that at the end of my recent statement, I thank the people of Iran for the 22nd of Bahman rally. However, to tell you the truth, that expression of gratitude was completely insufficient compared to what the Iranian nation deserves. The Iranian nation accomplished a magnificent feat in this year's 22nd of Bahman rally. I will tell you that according to the report that was delivered to me, the turnout was much higher than previous years. This was the case all over the country or in 98% of the cities of the country. In certain cities, this increase was 50%, in some cities it was 40%, and in some cities the increase was 30%. The enemy sees this movement, but he denies it in his propaganda. In his propaganda, he says that only thousands of people came out to the streets.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we've seen that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017 when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. The UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with the aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labeled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck, and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's Stock Exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favor of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations, and can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with US politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The
coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
Was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation, as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger, as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute. Whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people, and they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and this should change.
With far-right groups such as Pedega now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Akhil Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatih al-Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house, many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up, we must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami. Here we're talking about cutting your nails and for men, shortening your moustache. And that is, again, one of the sunnahs of Islam, where it is highly recommended on certain days for you to cut your nails. Tuesday has been mentioned, Wednesday and Thursday has been mentioned, Friday has been mentioned as well. Sometimes you come across some ahadith that, or some recommendations that if it's you're doing it on, for example, this particular day, then you start from your right, the far right hand, which would be your thumb on your right hand, and you finish with your thumb on your left hand. And sometimes it would be the opposite. Whatever the case may be, if you come across these kind of recommendations, and, you know, a good book to read as well, you know, besides Mafatih al-Hayat, is Makarim al-Akhlaq, the famous book Makarim al-Akhlaq, that does also speak about these kind of hygienic observations that we need to go through. Qala Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi lirrijal, that the Holy Prophet, praise and peace be upon him, said to men, Qussu adhafirakum. Wa qala linnisa, so he said to men, cut your nails. You know, make sure your nails are always as short as possible. And by the way, it's very bad to bite your nails, so it's bad for you to cut your nails with your teeth. And we have some riwayat from Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam that admonish this kind of act and say it's a very bad thing. And from what I remember, it was even said that it brings about faqr and poverty and nisyan, forgetfulness. I don't remember exactly what the context of that particular riwaya was, but you know, it is highly advisable not to cut your nails with your teeth or chew on your nails, which is unfortunately a habit that sometimes some people have. Qussu adhafirakum, for men. Wa qala linnisa, as for women, utrukna min adhafirikunna. So then he said to women, leave some of your nails. Utrukna min adhafirikunna doesn't mean that you prolong your nails so much that it becomes unhealthy or unhygienic, but he said that women should leave their nails to a certain length. And then he said, as to why women should leave their nails, فَإِنَّهُ أَزْيَنُ لَكُنَّ, because for women, it's a kind of zina, it's a kind of beautification of your hands when it comes to women. So women should leave their nails, in it being a kind of zina. Now, we're not talking about nail polish, we're not talking about putting those fake nails, we're not talking about all of those other things. We're talking about the natural nails for women. And I don't want to get into the fiqhi side of zina and things like that. That's beyond this particular discussion, but you know what the fiqhi rulings are. They're very, very clear with all of this.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح باید دو جلد باشه.
This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Then the next hadith is from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, where he talks about akhdhu sharib, about trimming your mustache for men. You know, there are numerous ahadith that speak about leaving your beards, and that beard is a nur for a man, that it illuminates you. It's a way of keeping your face as radiant. It's a sign of maturity, it's a sign of wisdom. And the istihbab is qabdatu yad, so much so that when you do hold onto it, you are able to grab some of what your beard has. You know, you don't want it to be too long, you know, and you also don't want it to be too short. You want it to be something presentable. And I think while talking about beards, you know, nowadays we know that it's like a fashion thing, you know. So once upon a time it was extremely difficult in the 80s, in the early 90s, for anyone to do anything having any kind of facial hair, you know. And it was really, really a very, very big struggle for people to get jobs or things like that, you know. And they saw it to be being dirty, you know. If someone had facial hair, they were an unhygienic and a dirty person, you know. But now all of a sudden it's fashion and everyone wants to have a beard and things like that. But again, to the reasonable level, and the moustache should never be long. The moustache should always be short. That's the Islamic kind of attitude to facial hair. أَخْذُ الشَّارِبِ مِنَ النَّظَافَةِ, that trimming your moustache is of cleanliness. وَهُوَ مِنَ السُّنَّةِ, and it is also a part of sunnah as well, sunnah of Islam. الطيب في الشارب كرامة, and also for a person to perfume their moustache as well, which is also a part of a sunnah. Now, coming back to the issue of cutting nails, and we said that we're talking about cutting nails, and we're talking also about the practice of trimming your moustache. And here, the hadith, there's a hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, where he says, إِنَّمَا قُصَّتِ الْأَظَافِرِ, the reason why nails should be cut, لِأَنَّهَا مَقِيلُ الشَّيْطَانِ, because it is the resting place for shaytan. مَقِيل means resting place. It's a resting place for shaytan. وَمِنْهُ يَكُونُ النِّسْيَانِ, and a person who doesn't, you know, take care of their nails and doesn't clean their nails or cut their nails, you know, that's one means of bringing about forgetfulness. We'll continue on with these topics in our next episode. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahireen.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's cries.
That was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
European News Bulletin.
Welcome from the British capital. My name's Amina Taylor. Good to have you with us, and we begin in Russia, because Moscow has called on Washington to end its gross interference and fake news push in Russia's domestic affairs. This just days after the U.S. Secretary of State accused Russian police of using, quote, harsh tactics to arrest protesters who were demonstrating for the release of the jailed Western-backed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Russian police arrested hundreds of protesters across the country in cities such as Moscow and St. Petersburg for staging illegal demonstrations over the weekend. According to the Kremlin, mass gatherings in most parts of Russia have been banned under rules aimed at curbing the spread of COVID-19. Mohsen Abbas has been following this one, and it must be said, Mohsen, what do you make of these interference allegations? Is Russia correct here to have a go at the U.S. for its so-called meddling in Russian domestic affairs?
It's perfectly within its rights to have a go. The fact is that since the end of the Cold War, there's been nothing but endless regime change in the foreign policy of the Americans. And it's forced Moscow to interpret these interventions in places like Bosnia, Kosovo, Iraq, you know, the list is endless, Libya, and of course their support for the color revolutions in the Arab Spring to boot. It all is evidence the United States has an insatiable drive for regime change. Now, it's also doing it right in Russia's own backyard, if you like. It's manifesting itself also with a reaction from Russia, which views all these U.S. missiles, defense technologies, the alliance politics that goes on, and the support for NGOs, even in this territory, as being a detrimental set of, if you like, covert operations to undermine the Russian establishment. So, you know, it's on record, of course. Steve Cole, in a 1992 Washington Post article, said very clearly in there that William Casey, the then director of the CIA, had launched subversive propaganda through Afghanistan into Uzbekistan, and they actually wanted to print Qurans to spread amongst the people in Uzbekistan in order that they would become a kind of Muslim, if you like, opposition to the Soviet Union at that time. But we know it goes on, and it's just something the Russians are obviously clearly fed up with, and they're going to deal with on their own, in their own backyard, in a very, very forthright manner.
Now we're seeing protests in other parts of the world, for example, over there in the occupied Palestinian territories. We're also seeing disruption in the very backyard of the United States. Has Biden got time to be worried about what's going on in Moscow?
Biden thinks of Russia as a threat, just like his predecessor. They may not say it in as open a set of terms as Trump did, but they see all of these rising economic powers in Eurasia as a threat, Iran, China, and Russia in particular. So I think that Washington's record showed in overthrowing over their governments is that it's dismal. It doesn't work.